So the lecture you're about to hear is from Psychology and Biology 3506, Neuropharmacology from Algoma University. I'm the instructor, Dave Brodbeck, Dr. Dave Brodbeck. So I hope you like it. I hope you get something out of it. Frankly, I only hope you get something out of it if you're one of my students. If you're not, that's great. And I'm glad you're listening in on a university class you're not taking. Fine. But yeah. So without further ado, let's listen to a little intro of a song and then a lecture.
All right, let's get going. And before we go, Jamie has a question. So before we get going, let me know, what do you want to know, Jamie?
Well, the big thing, and we'll talk about barbiturates today too, so I think that will also help because I'll show you that GABA receptor complex. I think that would be a pretty good idea. But one of the key things is the fact that part of the metabolic pathway for barbiturates is the microsomal ethanol oxidizing system, the VOS. And if that's used up at all, like you said, small amount, fine, but any amount might trigger that. But there's also, it might trigger the MEOS, but there is another really good reason because of the way GABA receptor complexes are built, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. It's a very good question. Because you're right, MEOS is normally only going to kick in when you drink a lot. So a small amount of alcohol, you say, oh, what a small amount, probably not. But there's another good reason. It makes it more likely that barbiturates work. If they're positive barbiturate modulators, alcohols, and also barbiturates are positive alcohol modulators. They're both positive GABA modulators. And the thing with GABA is it slows you down. And if you get slowed down too much, you stop. So that's kind of what's going on. Oh, we'll get more into it. It's a very good question. And in fact, segues nicely to what I want to talk about today. It's a very good question. And I will talk about, I've got a couple nice diagrams that hopefully can explain this when we talk about barbiturates. Other questions from last time? That was a really good one.
Anything else?
Okay, let's begin. So we were talking about alcoholism, the idea of the disease model that was Jelinek. The idea of physical dependence, tolerance, some of those things. You probably know my views on physical versus psychological anything. Up there with my views on physical versus mental health. It's just health. Anyway, the key thing here, the loss of control thing is actually probably not true. The idea that alcoholics lose control, that alcohol controls them, and they can't stop drinking once they start. Most research now suggests that a reasonable goal would be social drinking again. Like, it's not unreasonable. A lot of people who drink, though, are like, nah, who are alcoholics, like, yeah, I don't think I want to anymore. And that's fine. What I'm saying is, a reasonable goal for most people is, yeah, have a glass of wine with dinner, have a beer after you mow the lawn, that kind of thing. It's tough for a lot of people, and it's so ingrained in the way we think. AA views of substance abuse are so ingrained in the way we think that the loss of control thing is really important. It actually probably isn't. It actually probably isn't that big a deal. One of the other things you hear about is people who are alcoholics also have, quote, addictive personalities. There's not a whole lot of evidence that those exist. There's a lot of evidence that risk-taking personalities exist, though. So you're more likely to find that people who have any kind of substance abuse problem also really like roller coasters and scary movies. Now, I'm not saying that if you like scary movies, you're likely to become a heroin addict. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, though, it's risk-taking behavior. They're also more likely to have unprotected sex with people they've just met. Just as you probably know, I hope you know, not a great idea. Oh, but I almost made a really bad joke and decided not to.
I'll tell some of you later if you want to know the joke. if it's that important to you, but I've decided against it. All right. And now the idea of the family history positive thing. There are subtle differences between children alcoholics, children non-alcoholics in their brainwave patterns, but they're pretty subtle and they're not consistently found. Okay, what are some bad things about alcohol? Well, I'm not an idiot. I also know that alcohol is not great for you. Think about it. Alcohol poisoning is a weird term. It just isn't, it's overdosing in alcohol. That's what it is. We come up with special names for alcohol things because alcohol is so much in our culture that we have special names for that stuff. This usually happens, of course, because of injury. So it's a common thing to happen to younger people. It's much more common in younger people who don't have alcohol experience. Right? I'm more of an alcohol veteran than you guys are. I've been a first liner on the team for years. Of course, hangovers are bad. Right? They're bad. They're not fun. They're temporary, but they're no fun. You don't go, oh boy, a hangover. Or, oh well, a hangover. You go, oh shit, I'm hungover. Like, nobody's happy about it. You might laugh about it if it's you and all your friends together. Or even better, if you said to all your friends, I'm going to stop now, you guys are all going to have hangovers tomorrow, and they all laugh at you, the fun is waking them up the next day with, you know, maybe a Bloody Mary. Just like, hey, you want something to drink? So hangovers are no good. General bad behavior. One of the things about alcohol is it's depressant. It inhibits stuff. But one of the things it inhibits, how many laps have I made of this? It inhibits inhibition. It disinhibition. So you do things like, as I mentioned, unprotected sex, people you just met. Get into fights. Just tell people things you shouldn't tell them. People do that, and we've all experienced, I literally can see looks on faces even though I don't see that well. I can see that some of you have done or have heard many of these situations where people have told you their life story after hitting on you. You know, it's like, what? And then when you go, get away from me. Oh, you want to fight? Like, there's... Alcohol leads to a lot of really shitty behavior. Right? And I'm not even talking about the driving and all that other stuff. It can affect sex in a couple of ways. It can make you do stupid things sexually, like, you know, cheat on your spouse or your partner or whatever. It can also affect your sex life pretty negatively. Right? It can lead to... inability to have an erection, inability to have vaginal lubrication. Those make sex a lot more pleasant. Bad for your, from what I understand, bad for your liver. You can end up with, you know, cirrhosis, things like that. You can end up with Korsakoff syndrome. These are now in increasing levels of unlikelihood, but they can happen. So I'm not saying these things don't happen. Think about Korsakoff syndrome, or Korsakoff's dementia, it's sometimes called. It's a kind of cortical dementia. It involves not having enough vitamin B. People used to think it was just from alcohol. You got all this brain damage. You do get literal holes in your brain, like there's lesions all over your cortex. People used to say, well, that's from the alcohol. It's not from the alcohol. It's because you don't eat, because you devoted your life to alcohol. You get all your calories from vodka and shoe polish. And if you do that, you don't get any vitamin B. I don't know about you. I've never picked up a bottle of vodka in the liquor store and go, hey, look, enriched with all my daily nutrients. Part of a good breakfast, it says right here. So, in fact, I'm almost certain that would be illegal. So... Which shouldn't be. They actually should put vitamin B in vodka. That's a really good idea. Somebody should do that. Thing is, you get a vitamin B deficiency. This thing, same thing happens to people who are anorexic, by the way. Or people who have been through famines. There's more Korsakoffs there. And people have now figured out that, you know, it's not the alcohol per se. It's the fact that, and a lot of people wonder this, why aren't, you know, habitual drunks, why aren't they really fat? Alcohol makes you gain weight. But when all your calories come from alcohol, you'll lose weight. I'm not saying this is a diet plan. Okay? It's not a diet plan. I can tell you, however, that last couple before we do that. There's fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effects. So it's bad for fetuses. So if you're pregnant, perhaps cut down, perhaps stop. I can tell you that having the odd glass of wine with dinner, or having the odd beer, or even probably the odd cocktail, isn't going to cause this. But there's a reason. You talk to physicians, and if you say, is it okay? And they will say almost invariably, well, you really shouldn't. And you say, okay, but seriously. It's like when you go and you talk to somebody, borrowing a car, and they give you an interest rate. You go, okay, that's great. What's the real interest rate? So it's the same kind of thing. So you probably could have a drink every couple of days. The problem, and I've heard this from a number of MDs, is that if they told people you can have one every couple of days, there would be people who would save it up for 2 weeks and think they could then have 18 drinks. You can't, that's not what you do.
So it would have to be a minuscule amount?
It would be a glass of wine with dinner. Okay. A beer after, on a warm summer day, that kind of thing.
Concentration of.
Yeah, it's the amount at a time problem. We don't know what the safe level is, and zero is safe. And that's why MDs have gone, just don't drink. Just don't. But frankly, a friend of mine from back in Newfoundland, she's from France, and her husband had an in vitro baby. So, you know, that's a lot more fragile and everything. And her doctor in France said, just have a couple of glasses of wine a day. And if you smoke, try to cut down, because it's France. And they have a whole different world over there. And their kid's fine. Like his age. And you got to understand that they just don't want to tell you this because they want, you know, and I understand. One of the reasons I'm telling you this is I don't want you, when you see a pregnant woman having a glass of wine or a beer, they're under enough stress as it is. Do not think they're worse than Hitler, please. Don't be mean. People deserve a break. Okay? Alcohol isn't good for you, though, it's not good for the kid. So there's fetal alcohol effects, which is a spectrum of the fetal alcohol syndrome, which involves, well, I'm sure we'll have a presentation about it. I think somebody's already signed up for the topic. But it's also this involves cognitive defects. It involves physical abnormalities, facial. You can spot kids with FAS. And there's no treatment. There's behavioral regulation and management. There's no getting better from that. So this is the other reason I think people are told, look, just stop for a moment. I can also tell you that when they had babies, I had a friend of mine, he's from England, and when his mom had him in 1965, when he was born, she was given a pint of Guinness the day after to make her lactate so she could make milk out of the Guinness. And Ian's fine, so. Now, there are certain cancers that are more likely when you have too much alcohol. Pancreatic is probably the one that comes up. Esophageal cancer as well. Liver, of course. It's not like cigarettes, but they're not great for you. It's a carcinogen. But of course, it's completely legal. It makes no sense at all. Alcoholism. There's a couple good things. Is it better for heart disease? Like, is it good for your heart to have a couple of drinks a day? People originally said it was the tannins in red wine. Tannins are compounds that have that astringent kind of, you know, when you ever had cheap red wine that makes your teeth go, those are tannins. Good red wine, but it's a real, I don't know much about wine, but in my experience, the stuff that you start paying real money for a bottle of wine doesn't do that anymore. Right? You ever had like a $100 bottle of wine just once? But you get past that, it's like, I can't tell the difference. By the way, it wasn't my money that bought that wine. Okay. Then people said, oh, it must be beer also. So they tried beer, because dark beer has tannins. Turned out also, you know, lighter beers do too. There are data that suggest having a cocktail every day might be good for you. Maybe. It probably isn't really great for you. But a couple a day probably isn't hurting you either. But that's just a couple. It doesn't say seven. That doesn't say it. I said.
So a couple is a different number than, you know, sitting down and polishing off a 40-ouncer in an afternoon. That's how I spend my summer. Sit in the backyard drinking rye and watching, listening to music. Okay. Questions? Not good. Okay. Next. So treatments. Alcoholics Anonymous works for some people. It works for about as many people as it, on average, their success is about the same as people who don't do it to Alcoholics Anonymous. But it is effective. It's a little more effective than anything else. So it's probably the case that they're wrong about a bunch of stuff. It's more likely that people getting together and meeting new people, more reinforcement. And it's people that you can talk to, right? Other alcoholics. People have tried antidepressants. This has been tried, the idea that people must be drinking because they're depressed. Who's that? You okay?
Yeah, fine. Okay. I think Kendra should stop wearing her hair.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's okay. Behavior therapy. What about behavior therapy? What about doing something like, I talked about ant abuse, right? You drink it and you get sick. That can work. Cold turkey is the most common way people stop drinking. The most common way people take any drugs or stop drugs is they just stop. All right. Anything else there? No. So I will now give you a very quick drink recipe. So what you need is two shots of vodka. One shot of creme de cacao or any other chocolate. One shot of cherry brandy. Top it with Coke in a glass. Put two maraschino cherries. You now have the Black Forest Coke. You know what Black Forest cake? This is a drink that tastes like Black Forest cake. Was invented by my father. Not the name, my mom came up with the name, give my mom the credit, it's very clever. My dad just called me and said, David, I've invented a new drink. My mom said, let's call it the Black Forest Coke. So that's that. All right. Any questions about alcohol before we move on to benzodiazepines and barbiturates? You good? Next one, which is here.
That's not
it.
There
it is.
That one.
Oops, that's not the right slide. No, that's actually, it's funny, I just said to myself, that's not the right slide, but that's the slide that will answer Jimmy's question for later. Okay. So let's move on and talk about benzodiazepines and barbiturates. Along with methaqualone, which you don't hear much about anymore, those are quaaludes, and methylbenmate, see, I can't even say that one. These are what are called sedative hypnotic or tranquilizers. Sometimes they're called minor tranquilizers to distinguish them from antipsychotic drugs. Right. So they're tranquilizers. These are things that slow you down. They're like alcohol and, say, sniffing gas. They facilitate functioning of GABA, what we always call the universally inhibitory neurotransmitter. This is the most common inhibitory neurotransmitter in your brain. And they make it work better. And GABA slows you down. These things slow you down. Okay? So, barbiturates replace things like opium and brandy for MDs. Because it used to be when you had an operation or a lot of pain, they'd get you drunk. So they just say, here, drink all this and bite on this, and now we're going to cut into you. Or they give you some opium, hopefully knock you out and not kill you. It wasn't really before like 1910, medicine was just guessing. And I'm not kidding. It was basically just like, well, there's obviously imbalance of the humors or something. people didn't really know. 1910's a little strong, but 1900. Like nowadays, you go, and if your doctor said, I don't know what that is, you'd be shocked. Today, you'd be shocked. Back then, you'd go, I don't either, man. There's no internet. Yeah, Joe.
So what do barbiturates basically replace?
Oh, they replace these. So they replace them in the way that they were used by doctors. So the way it used to be when you had an operation, they would, well, today when you have an operation, they give you, put a mask on you, they give you an anesthetic and you go to sleep and you wake up. They used to just get you drunk, so brandy.
Anyway, though.
Yeah, so they replaced those things. Yeah.
I'm a little pissed off because teachers weren't here.
They're drunk, though.
Sorry.
It's okay. So, what are we doing here? Where are we? Yes. So phenobarbital is actually still used to prevent seizures. So it's a, what do you call it? It's a, well, tranquilizer, because it's the right word. That's what I'm looking for. So it's still used to prevent seizures. So we still use some barbiturates. Most of them have been replaced by benzodiazepines. These are some actually pretty good stories. I guess I'll come back to that in a sec. I'll talk about how barbiturates were discovered by Bayer. Bayer is a very famous drug developer. What did Bayer develop? Bayer developed aspirin. Bayer developed heroin. And again, he was not trying to make a drug that would be addictive to the whole world and get them and start an opiate crisis. He was trying to make the world better. He called it heroin, like it was a hero. Then he was making these other drugs, and he was making this drug that he took urea and barbituric acid. Yes, and he mixed urea. I'm sorry, with esters that come out of apples. Okay. And it's called barbiturate. It sounds like Barbara. Well, this is probably not true, but there is a story that Bear liked a woman named Barbara who was a waitress at a local tavern, and he collected her pee. This, I hope this isn't true. But look, whatever you're into, I don't kink shame anybody, but that's a little weird. Now, it's also quite possible that that's not true. The one that most people accept is that when they developed this drug, they then went, the team went out to a pub that was a place where German artillery, is the German, there was our German, artillerymen hung out, an artillery regiment, and the patron saint of artillerymen, because there's a patron saint of everything. There is Saint Barbara. And this bar was a place where artillerymen went. So there was Saint Barbara stuff everywhere. So they said, we'll call it barbiturates. That's a better explanation than Barbara's pee. So I'm going with that. We're sticking with that, okay? At least to me. I mean, it could be, though. I like the fact that his friends made fun of him. I think that's kind of funny and say, yeah, you and Barbara, you collected her pee to make drugs, you weirdo. So I kind of think that might be funny. Sternbach et al. Discovered benzodiazepines by brute force. Brute force means you just keep making molecules and see what they do. So they discovered a couple. The first ones they discovered were lorazepam and then diazepam. Okay?
Bring it back.
Can I have a slug of one of those?
Sure.
I'm extremely thirsty, and I have a roadie, it seems, so.
Yeah.
Bless, thank you so much. So much. Okay. The final one we'll just quickly, I want to bring up, because a lot of people like is the wrong word, like to talk about this, is Rohypnol or flunetrazepam. Rohypnol's the trade name. It's really just a benzodiazepine. All it is, it's like Valium, it's like anything else. There's nothing magical about it. It was readily available, and it became the quote date rape drug. Now that drug actually has to have blue dye in it, The pills have to be have blue dye in them, so you can see them dissolved in a drink, for example.
It's kind of messed up.
What's that?
It's kind of messed up. It has to be like that.
It was. People got really excited about this, and justifiably, Dave Reeves are real concerned. It's not like it's. But they say, well, I don't think it's regulation. I think drug companies just said, what we'll do is we'll just make it blue. Then you'll see it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Oh, looked over there and I still can't see out of that one. If you want a rapid effect for these drugs, you go with an intravenous. We wouldn't be doing this, right? But if you wanted this, like in a hospital, if they're calming you down for some reason, they might go IV. So a lot of times if you're going in for, say, chemotherapy, which is an intense experience, not a lot of fun, they'll give you some diazepam quite often. And they would give it to you like this because it's like we want to happen quickly. Now, you wouldn't be, if you were at home, you wouldn't be setting that up, obviously. You would take it orally. Orally, diazepam peaks in about 30 minutes. So if you take a Valium, or two, or five, they'll peak around 30 minutes. And they feel like being drunk. It feels like being drunk. Like taking too many Valiums just feels like you're hammered. I'm not saying you should do that. I'm saying that that's what it does feel like. That I do have some drug experience there. Absorption, here's part of your answer, Jamie. Absorption from the digestive system is actually greatly increased by alcohol. So the alcohol actually increases the absorption rate of benzodiazepines and barbiturates just by being there. All right.
And how does that work?
I don't know. It's a good question. Find out, write your paper on that. Whoops. There's actually, I should go back. I had a point there. I'll make it. There's a great deal of variability, too. So there are benzodiazepines and barbiturates, and I'm talking about these together. They're pretty similar, but they're not the same drug. Eh? But there are some that work very quickly. Like diazepam, there are other ones that take a much longer period of time. There's basically a drug like this for every possible situation where you want to slow someone down. Okay? All right. Questions so far? Any ones I can answer? John?
So, what does super additive mean?
Oh, right, super additive. Remember, again, super additive means, remember what additive means. If I have just two things, they add them together, you get a sum, right? So if it's two and two, if I get two levels of drunkenness from alcohol and two from some pill from diazepam, if they're additive, I should be four levels of wasted. The thing is, two and two for alcohol and barbiturates doesn't lead to four, it leads to like 11. Because of the fact that, for example, alcohol's increases the absorption rate of benzodiazepines and barbiturates. So they actually work faster because you have something else in your system. It's like, I can't think of any other analogy, but does that help? Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. Oh, please. I'm trying to figure out how to speak again. So did you say that Valium and Mohypnol were some of the first to be discovered, or was it just Valium?
Valium's less diazepam, and the other one starts with the L that I never remember the pronunciation of. Lorazepam were the first to discover. So now how do we, let's look at distribution of these things. Yes.
No, it's okay.
Liz.
Is there a functional difference between
Yeah. Well, what do you mean, actually, before you, what do you mean by functional difference? What do you mean by that?
What do you mean by that?
Something different. Yeah, like, is there, like, a distinctive difference between
Well, they operate somewhat differently. The results are the same. Barbiturates are a lot more dangerous than benzodiazepines. It's a lot easier to kill yourself taking barbiturates.
Why is that?
You'll find out in a moment.
Cool.
Yeah. But in a few slides, we'll get there. Because it's the same thing to answer Jamie's question from before. What happens is they, because of the way GABA receptor complexes work.
Okay.
Yeah. So more lipid-soluble ones go through the blood-brain barrier faster. They get redistributed to fat cells. So an interesting thing happens with these drugs. They have what's called a biphasic curve. There's the first peak, okay? Now, some of it's already been stored in some fat cells, and then you get a second peak that's small, and then it goes down. Biphasic curve. And that's not uncommon. We'll talk about that. That'll come up again with other kinds of drugs. And a lot of the metabolites are psychoactive. So as it's being broken down, remember yesterday, the other day we were talking about metabolites of alcohol, and they aren't psychoactive. They just make you sick. Well, these are also psychoactive. Liz, you have another question.
Yeah. So what is like the component that makes it a benzodiazepine, and is that in itself lipid-soluble? Like, how would they change that?
I'm not entirely sure I understand your question. So, what makes it a benzodiazepine? The molecule, the shape of the molecule.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what makes all of these classes of drugs, it makes them all have certain, what's the word I'm looking for? Characteristics is the shape of the molecule, then, which means what it can bind to. When you think of the shape of a molecule, think of it like the shape of a key going into a lock. Yeah, exactly. Change the shape of the molecule again.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah. Oops, place. They also cross the placental barrier. So when you take Valium, if you're pregnant, your baby's taking Valium. One of the things that's rough for pregnant women is that, of the many things that are rough for pregnant women, is the fact that everything you take, you're also giving to somebody else, or almost everything. So you have to be incredibly careful about what you ingest, sort of food, drink, drugs, whatever. But say you're taking benzodiazepines for epilepsy. They'll try to get it down as low as they can, but you have to control your epilepsy. Your pregnancy is important, but so's your dad, right? So same thing with, you think about, if we want to use other classes of drugs, think about antidepressants. They cross the placental barrier. Your kid is taking Prozac. In utero, but it's also the case that, like, do you want to be completely depressed? Like, so it's a calculus that has to be done by a woman and her doctor, and nobody else. So, what these things do is they modify the effect of GABA. And remember, GABA lets chlorine in, which makes it harder to fire. Remember, negative, harder to fire, positive, more likely to fire. They are positive GABA modulators. I've said the same thing now three different times with different words, okay? Wait a second, I think I've said the same thing four times.
I think you did.
Yeah.
I'm feeling better.
Good, I'm glad. GABA, it's more effective now. I could, let's go for five. No. Well, this is actually why GABA, the thing about barbiturates is they can actually open an ion channel by themselves. They are GABA, but they're GABA enough that they can do the job. So here's one diagram. This is more of a schematic. So you can see here, we have a chlorine ion channel. That's right in the middle. That thing is gonna open up like this and let chlorine in and then close. And the various locks and keys are here. Benzodiazepines, because it's got a dashed line, means it doesn't open GABA by itself. That's what this means in this diagram. Same thing, but look, so that's GABA, straight line, barbiturates, straight line. Barbiturates at low levels just act as GABA modulators. They make it a little more effective. And you'll see why again in a second, how that works. I know how that works. But, in a second, at higher doses, they will open up the ion channel themselves.
I was wondering if by metabolites you mean things that metabolize, like break down the benzodiazepine?
No, the things that it's broken down into.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I think you literally just explained this, but how do they open them by themselves?
I haven't explained it yet.
Okay,
the next slide explains it.
Well, the next slide in my narration. I hope we'll explain it. Okay. Yeah, there you go. Now this is a beautiful, very pretty diagram. But let's take a look at the one on the left. So to open the chlorine pore, you need to have binding at a beta 2 site and an alpha 1 site, both of those. So as you can see here, beta 2, alpha 1, GABA opens chlorine pore. Right? Same thing here. Here we have a benzodiazepine receptor, which goes on, it's got a gamma 2, which has nothing to do with anything else right now for our purposes. But it's also already activating the alpha 1 site. It's already operating the alpha 1 site. So all it needs, so if we've already got that operating, that alpha 1 site, any of the other two, say GABA sites, as long as they hit, they're going to, as long as we have binding there, it's going to make it more likely that that chlorine pore will open. So you can see how this is a modulator. It makes it more effective. It doesn't actually open it by itself. Now, benzodiazepine, both of these you can see here, but there's a barbiturate receptor, and a barbiturate receptor will open both of them. It basically mimics, because you can have a barbiturate receptor on an alpha 1, and it only opens an alpha 1, and a barbiturate receptor that only opens a beta 2. But that means that enough of a dose, it opens the chlorine ion channel. Because it means if there's enough molecules, one's going to bind. Let me just draw that in then. Let us add in, we'll do it in yellow. So we're going to have a barbiturate receptor here and a barbiturate receptor here. So if we've got enough that it's going to bind here and it's going to bind here, which now is the same as that and opens the chlorine channel.
Cool.
Yeah, it's cool, except it's also scary. But it is very cool. Jamie?
Can a barbiturate receptor, like a single one that's situated between, open it on its own?
The barbiturate receptors tend to be only on... Yes, if they were, yes. I was going to say, but I'm not actually sure what I was going to say. So yeah. Are there ones that are just basically on... They would be right here, you're saying? Yeah, that's possible. I think that's possible. So you can see that basically, the other thing is you should also see that if we have barbiturate and benzodiazepine receptors, that means that we make our own. We make it, and they're modulators for the GABA system. The only thing is we just take advantage of that because we make molecules of that shape ourselves. And we give them to people, and they take them, and they get wasted. All right. Here's even another picture. So what these things do again is they're positive GABA modulators. So if they make GABA more effective and GABA is inhibitory, that means the more of them you take, the more inhibition there is in your nervous system. What happens when all your neurons shut down? You're dead. When your neurons stop firing, you stop being you. You start just being a big hunk of meat. You'll also note, hey, look, an alcohol receptor. It's on a GABA receptor complex. So you can see why, again, not just the MEOS and all that, but also, so again, this answers the second part of the other question you had. It's because this is here. So we have alcohol receptors and benzodiazepine receptors on the same neurotransmitter receptor site, and if that's the case, they're going to be super additive. They're going to make it more likely for make GABA work better, make it more likely for you to, well, you know, die.
Do they have to be on the same receptor site to be super additive? Is that how
it would be blah, 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 blah. They are, in essence, all the same. There's variation, but they're, in essence, all like this.
So,
so
what would be an example of another type of, like, super additive?
Geez, offhand, let me think of a super additive. Probably two, not two stimulants. Oh, I would guess, oh, sure. Alcohol and heroin. Yeah.
So heroin
binds
like the same.
It's not. No.
Okay.
Not there. It's not. This is the beautiful thing about this is it's so right there. It's pure, and also the thing with the MIOS system. It's not quite as clear that way with something like two depressants, like opiate and an alcohol. Same sort of thing with, and some of these things are also. Because of behavioral things like alcohol and stimulants, or stimulants and depressants tend to be super additive, and that's simply because we psychologically use fatigue as a way to realize we're wasted from the depressant.
Okay.
So one of the ways that when you've had too much to drink, one of the ways you know it is, oh, well, I'm feeling kind of tired. And if you're drinking Red Bulls or snorting cocaine, you're much less likely to feel tired.
A unique thing.
Yeah, I think it is. From what I know, I think for sure it is. Yeah. It's probably not unique, but it's unique in the drugs we will talk about.
Okay.
Yeah. And in fact, you'll find out later, does this one have, there's also a nicotine receptor on here. Not on this one, but GABA also has nicotine receptors, so there's a physiological reason why people crave cigarettes when they drink alcohol. It's wild. As you probably would have guessed, but all right. Also, barbiturates block what are called AMPA receptors. Okay, what is an AMPA receptor? An AMPA receptor, they're glycine modulators. Glycine is another positive neurotransmitter. So now we have GABA being made more powerful, and we're shutting down glycine. So you do those together, and glycine is a really common neurotransmitter. Whenever I see neurotransmitter, I do this with my hand, because I'm assuming they're mostly up here. So that's not good. So ethanol is the same thing. They also block straight up block glycine receptors, acetylcholine receptors, and serotonin receptors. And the specific serotonin receptor they block is serotonin 3, 5-HT3 receptors. And 5-HT3 receptors do a few interesting things. One of the things they do is they make you sick, like they make you vomit. They also make you feel. They increase your nociception, your perception of pain and unpleasantness and discomfort. You ever wonder why when you drink too much or you take too many of anything, you get sick? That's why. Now that's barbiturates. Benzodiazepines are way more selective. They're way more selective. So benzodiazepines are a lot more selective. They're operating on GABA, and that's it, on the GABA receptor site, whereas barbiturates are doing all kinds of great stuff. Barbiturates are really dangerous drugs, and there's a reason that benzodiazepines, that there was a move on to discover something else, because people were dying from barbiturates. Yep.
Sorry, I just wanted to double check. Glycine is an excitatory neurotransmitter.
Okay. Yeah. So what it's doing is it's shutting down glycine and making the GABA, like it's double barrel.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. Which, because these are barrels, they're fists. I don't know why I did that. So that's barbiturates. Benzodiazepines just work on a GABA receptor. They're much more safe. It's very rare. Like, if you go to a hospital and if you go to the emergency room and you got something bad has happened to you, they may very well give you something to calm you down. Right? Like, if you've been in a very bad situation and you're freaking out, they may give you a pill. And that pill is almost certainly diazepam. They give you some Valium to calm you down. No one ever says, just give that guy some phenobarbital. Because that could, you know. And they're not going to give you a pill like that if you're drunk. You hope. All right, effects. The effects are basically like being drunk from these things. These are all effects that I think we'll all recognize. One of the things that barbiturates affect blood pressure, and benzodiazepines don't. So barbiturates actually slow you down. Your heart doesn't beat as much. Benzodiazepines don't. But they both have anticonvulsant properties. So they are both actually still used to control epilepsy. Much more common to be given barbiturates benzodiazepines rather than barbiturates. And I have a friend, an old student of mine, who has epilepsy, and she takes benzodiazepines every day. And she has a driver's license and a PhD. I don't know which one of those is harder. For me, it would be driver's license. But she takes pills every day, and she drives, and everything's fine. The reason I mentioned driving is because she's not taking so much that she's impaired. She's taking enough to control any potential of a seizure. By the way, even if she was taking enough to be, I've seen her have a grand mal seizure, and you'd rather have her drunk if she was driving. You don't do a lot of driving when you're having an epileptic seizure. It doesn't work. If you've seen it and you know what to do, it's like, oh, she'll be fine. But if you've never seen it before, and she didn't know she was epileptic until she was like 20, she was working in my lab back in Newfoundland. I thought, it's like, oh my God, what's wrong? And she's fine. But it was really something. It's really something to see. But benzodiazepines are used a lot for muscle relaxants. So, you know, it's interesting. Because they're so similar to alcohol, having a cut, and I'm not suggesting self-medicating. But, so now I'm about to. Remember, I am a doctor. Not that kind. Point is, if you had maybe a muscle strain in your back or something, you might take a muscle relaxant pill. Having a martini would do the same thing. I actually prefer just having a drink if I'm doing this, because it's like, I'll have a drink. Pills scare me. I don't know. But yeah, they're great muscle relaxants. There are REM effects, just as exactly the ones you'd expect. With these drugs, you may go to sleep, but you may not get any REM sleep. You may just get, you know, the sleep you get when you drink too much. You guys over here, with a lot of laughing about alcohol, I'm just saying. You see a lot of people drunk, haven't you? So, maybe not, I don't know. I'm just guessing, having a little bit of fun. Scene, right. So, thing is, I think we all know, either from seeing people or from ourselves, that you don't get a good night's sleep when you drink yourself to sleep. Like, it's not good. You wake up, I've been asleep for 16 hours and I want to go back to bed. You know that one? We've all had that one, right? This is what happens with these things. Because you don't get REM, and you need REM. You get REM rebound the next day. So if you have a bad, like you take these pills and you go to sleep, you don't get good REM the next night, you'll just have extra dreaming. Yeah, please.
REM effects and rebound, is that a result of both? Or
both of them do that, yeah. Yeah, thanks. I should have pointed that out. Yes, John.
So what does REM stand for?
Oh, rapid eye movement. You know when someone's asleep, and if you look at their eyeballs, you can actually, don't look, because then you wake them up. But underneath, like, next time you see somebody sleeping, which, I don't know, you'll see that underneath their eyes, when you're dreaming, your eyes move back and forth. Yeah. It's also the name of a band from the 80s that I really like. I was the first of my friends to listen to R.E.M. because I read about them in Rolling Stone. Yep.
So for someone who takes benzodiazepines regularly, like someone who has epilepsy, do they never get good sleep then?
You're usually just like you get sleep tolerance. Yeah. I think I have to actually ask my friend Andrea, but I think. Yeah, I remember her saying something about it, but I can't remember what it was. But I think you would certainly get tolerance to that. Yeah, but you would have it would be an effect. Like it would be serious. You would have less REM in your life. Yeah. Like it's not gonna stop you from dreaming, but I don't think you'd ever be as rested as someone that doesn't take them. Yeah, I don't think so. Tough to ask her. This should sound a whole lot like alcohol. The first thing you feel is euphoria. It feels nice. Oh, I feel great. And then you have what's called a liking reaction. And I got that in quotes because it sounds like I'm just saying, yeah, you like it. No, drug liking is a real thing. It's a technical term. It means that you find something pleasant. So actually, I guess it just means liking. But I would have a drug liking reaction to these drugs because I have a drug liking reaction to alcohol. Some people don't like the way they feel from alcohol. They would not have a liking reaction to benzodiazepines and barbiturates, right? I don't know if I've told you guys, but I know last term when I taught 2606 to a lot of you, I talked about how with opiates, the drug liking reaction most of us get from taking an opiate, it's like, oh boy, this is fun. Like it's actually fun to be high. But some people don't. My mom, when she broke her leg, when she was like, I don't know, well, how old was that? Maybe 25 years ago. She hated it. And she was like, I remember talking to her on the phone. She's like, well, I have to take these drugs, these Percocets or whatever they were, you know, some kind of opiate. And I was like, yeah, okay. I said, is it fun? And she said, it's horrible. It feels like I'm floating. I said, that sounds awesome. She says, no, I hate it. So then don't take them. That's my advice, Mom, is don't take the drugs if you don't like them. And then, you know, I said, give them to Dad. He could use calming down a little bit. And then you get fatigued, right? This is exactly what we get from alcohol, isn't it? You feel silly and you do crazy things and it's like, oh yeah, I like being with my friends and being drunk. And then you're like, yeah, I'm gonna go home. Like that's a Saturday night right there. You know, or a Friday or a Thursday. When I was an undergrad, it was Thursday. Isn't that Wednesday night? Weekend starts on Wednesday now, probably, right? Because it was Thursday when I was an undergrad, so I assume it just keeps going back. Where it feeds back onto itself, so now it's just... confusion. So, and I don't just mean like, I don't know what to do, man. Like, that's not what I mean. I mean, confusion, again, this is a technical term. It's like that, except it's... kind of like the way I was right there. That's a little bit of act. So, not knowing what you're doing, not knowing where you are, that kind of thing. Okay? You get a decrease in visual acuity. This is all like alcohol, everybody. Divided attention becomes extremely difficult. Divided attention, we only have a finite amount of attention, which we can actually measure. Psychology is cool. So, we have a finite amount of attention. So if I have one task to do, ever think about driving a car? A lot of things to attend to. The speed, the road, other drivers, lights. You gotta divide your attention. Divided attention becomes much more difficult with these drugs, just like it does with alcohol, which should explain to you why you should not be driving a freaking car on these drugs. Your reaction time increases. Remember, reaction time increases means it takes longer to react to things. Reaction time increasing is bad. Things going up isn't always good. Sometimes it's really bad. And that's what it would be in this case, especially, again, if you're driving a freaking car. One of the things that's kind of cool is you get effects on acquisition of new knowledge, but not on recall of it. So it's hard to learn things, but you can remember them. So it's easy to remember stuff you've already learned, but it's hard to learn things on the drugs. This is one of the other reasons why these drugs can be given during chemotherapy. Because if you take a pill of these
before you get to the, and especially if you're doing chemo IV at a clinic or something, a lot of times they'll give you these drugs to fail. So nowadays you say, just take some drugs, some weed. But seriously, but what that does is you can't then learn to associate being sick with the hospital, because chemo often makes you sick. Yeah.
Sorry, this is just kind of back to the question I asked before. So again, with someone that takes these drugs regularly, how long does it take them to get, because like here it says like don't drive, but you said your friend can drive. Like,
oh yeah, yeah. But she's still, you gotta understand, it's a very low level. She's getting enough to control her seizures.
Oh, okay.
She's not taking 300 milligram pills or something, at the, you know.
Yeah.
So it's the same, it would be like taking a, and I don't know these are the numbers, but I'm just gonna say this, okay? It'd be like the difference between taking half a shot of vodka and finishing your day, you'd have no problem. I'm assuming you'd drink alcohol now. You have four shots of vodka, it would affect you, right? Yeah.
So are these effects only for like taking these drugs in big amounts, or like?
Yes. Okay. The more of the drug you take, the more of the effect of the drug you have. I think that's a fair statement, yes. Please.
The acquisition one, does that have something to do with like the you shouldn't study high?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's hard to learn stuff if you can't. Like, if it happens during acquisition, you're not gonna learn anything. Yep. Yeah, some great questions there, buddy. This is good.
Very good.
What else here? Oh, you get a hangover. Like, you can actually, it's very similar to alcohol. Considering it's affecting the same systems, this shouldn't be surprising. Yeah, I see a hand back there.
So like you said, the acquisition.
Yep. Oh, right, okay, yeah. These things are typically tested using lists of words. So that is episodic memory. It's probably also true of semantic memory, though.
So it kind of makes your semantic memory better?
Worse. Yeah, because
so
if you can't learn new stuff
while
you're on the drug, that means you just have it. You don't learn it, like, you don't acquire the knowledge to begin with.
Yeah.
It never gets in. Yeah, if that makes sense, like it never makes it in.
Do you get blackouts at all?
You can, yeah. This is all exactly like the alcohol stuff, down to like hangovers, blackouts. Yeah, this is very similar to alcohol. And in fact, the impairment that you would see from someone on something, let's say like Valium, looks just like they're drunk. Yes, John?
So let's say you would pass out.
Oh yeah, totally, yeah, blackouts. Yeah, so you can pass out from these things. You can kill yourself with these easily. Don't, please, but I'm saying that this is a way that you could. Well, no, I want to make sure that you people don't think I'm advocating for some of you to off yourselves. I mean, that would be not nice and morally reprehensible. So don't drive a car. If you're taking enough of these, again, with my friend, it's to the point where this was after months and months of testing the dose out, getting the right dose.
Right.
And then her driving short distances, you know, and not on highways. Like, it was very serious stuff. Now, again, she didn't know she had epilepsy until she was in her 20s. And she had a seizure in my lab one day. It was a wild thing to see. I thought she was choking, so I tried to give her the Heimlich maneuver, which wasn't very helpful. She was choking while she was having a seizure. But, I mean, I thought I was saving her life. I thought I was a hero. So, obviously, this is all about me. So, I thought I was awesome. Turns out, she has the gall to have epilepsy. Okay, so you get less, you get more exploration in lab animals. They move more. It's disinhibition. It's just we talk about opiates, same thing. Right? It's a taming effect. It seems weird at first. Why would they run around more? But lab rats don't run around in big open fields. They're on 4x8 sheets of plywood. They would. The first thing they do is they try to either run off, or they try to find a place to hide, and they can't. And if the thing has edges, what they'll do is they'll get right up into one of the corners and try to get. Like, they don't like it. Yeah, they don't like it because it just makes a great deal of sense. They would end up getting eaten by, you know, birds of prey.
Okay, now, this is a little bit weird. So, we can reward animals in many different schedules. One of them is fixed ratio. So, if we talk about, let's say, an FR 10, a fixed ratio 10 means every 10th response the animal makes, it gets food. Okay? Okay. Fixed interval responding, let's say a fixed interval 10, means the first response after 10 seconds gets reinforced, gets food. The weird thing about both benzodiazepines and barbiturates is they increase fixed ratio responding. That may fit in with taming effect that's going on. But they get a decrease in fixed interval responding. So that may be in a timing effect. This may be we know these drugs actually slow your clock down. And you being a rat, you being a pigeon. So the FI part is probably a timing effect. It's probably a timing effect. It's also the case, the FR thing is probably a taming effect, but it's also, the timing part shouldn't be ignored there either, because one of the timing and counting systems in vertebrates, I'm just gonna say that, damn it, are very closely related to each other. There's a lot of data suggesting that timing and counting are served by a whole lot of systems that are used by both. So there are all kinds of these little sort of subsystems, and the timing module and the counting module use a lot of those same subsystems. Yeah, Erin.
Is the increase in the FR in relation to control?
Yes.
Is that okay?
Yes. So because both these things, FR and FI, are affected by time, by the timing system, it's quite possible that it's something that both timing and counting share. So I think that timing effect affects both of them, even though the fixed ratio one also probably has something to do with the taming effect. Animal timing. You want to learn more about animal timing? Next year, take special topics in cognitive psychology, animal cognition, with me, Dave Brodbeck. I'll be your host. We'll have a series of guest speakers, and by guest speakers, I mean it'll mostly just be me with different disguises. I'm literally making that up as I go along. There'll be no cosplay of famous psychologists.
Not even.
Unless you want to. I mean, if you guys want to do it, that's great. I'm going to just look at you and mock you if you do it, but great. But yeah, that'll be a fun class. You get an increase in punished behavior. Okay, now I'm going to tell you that we're sometimes mean to rats. So every time the rat pushes the bar, you shock him. You stop pushing the bar pretty quickly. You don't shock him so much that it's going to kill him, or even really hurt that bad. It's unpleasant, basically. Now, how do you know? How do I know? Because I've set up a shock generator machine in an operant box, and the way you see if it's enough is you put your hand on the bottom of the cage, and when you feel anything, you go, that's enough. Like, it's enough that you just feel... And I don't mean like if you ever plugged in something that is short and you feel like, ah! It's not like that. It's like something just goes, like you feel a little bit of tingling. It's not even as much as you get from like when you do your older nerd, you know, your funny bone. It's not even that much. Like it's not pleasant. And I understand that I weigh like 1,000 times more than a rat. But it's not like you're cooking the poor little rat. It's unpleasant and he will stop, but you're not permanently damaging the poor thing. I don't think it's psychologically great for the animal. But, you know, what do you want to do with this to people? So, it actually, you get an increase in punished behavior. That makes sense, because, again, we have disinhibition, inhibition, right? Okay. We get the dissociation effects. What I mean by this is, if you do learn, it's hard to acquire things on the drug, but it's not impossible. You can learn, don't do as well. But if you learn something on the drug, you won't remember it off the drug. We talked about this with alcohol. It's the same freaking thing. And this is wonderful because if you did learn to associate sickness with the cancer center you're going to because you get sick from chemo when you're at the cancer center, like a treatment center, you won't go get chemo anymore. Or you will, but you will start getting sick on your way there. You don't want any of those things to happen. So you'll be given a drug like this, and it's basically just to make it so you don't associate those two things together. It's a behavioral medicine thing. It's really cool. And nowadays, again, like a lot of times what's used is THC, because it's even cheaper. You just buy it at the, you know, I think you can buy THC stuff at the corner store now. Feels that way. I can't get liquor delivered to my house, but I can call right now and be a guy with weed at my house when I get home. It's, I guess it's always been like that, except now it's legal. all right. Tolerance, acute tolerance develops right away, just like it does with alcohol. The first beer doesn't get you as drunk as the second, that gets you drunker than the second beer. Works like that, same thing with these drugs. Chronic tolerance develops first the depressive effects. Now, this is when you think you might wonder, does my friend who has to take a benzodiazepine every day as an anticonvulsant, does she, is she slowed down? The answer to that is no, but it's because she's developed tolerance to the depressive effects. Next is the anti-anxiety effects. These are also really nice anti-anxiety meds. So if you're really freaking out, again, you know the expression, take a Valium. Big in the 80s. It was big in the 80s because a lot of people abused Valium in the 80s. It was just another drug that we had floating around our high school. Hi, Mom. You probably didn't know that, did you? I think my mom's found out a lot of things about my youth by listening to these podcasts. You get, within the benzodiazepines, you get cross-tolerance, meaning if I give you benzodiazepine A, take benzodiazepine B, they're the same drug. It's called cross-tolerance. There's some cross-tolerance between barbiturates and alcohol. Barbiturates are a lot more like alcohol than benzodiazepines are. Oops, sorry about that.
Doors.
Yeah, well, let's make sure that everybody got all this stuff, so. Yeah. Yeah. So within the benzodiazepines, there's cross-tolerance. There's also cross-tolerance between alcohol and barbiturates. They're very similar drugs, these things. One comes in a pill, one you shake up and pour into a delicious, lovely glassware. Okay, now withdrawal's a bit different between the two classes of drugs, so let's look at them one by one. Within barbiturates, you get REM rebound, tremors. Typically, by the way, as a rule, the withdrawal symptoms from a drug are, you ever stop and look at the gestures you're making as you're talking? Why am I doing all these things? The withdrawal symptoms from a drug are usually kind of the opposite of what the effects of the drug are. So REM rebound, tremors, like that, insomnia, nausea, seizures, hallucinations. So you see, these things can be used as, that's alcohol. That's just like alcohol. It's very similar, right? Now, withdrawal from barbiturates is a touch different, right? Benzodiazepines, you get agitation, depression. Look at the actual DTs, like the literally what you get from alcohol. REM rebound again. And the withdrawal here is two stages. The first stage is the withdrawal, and you can see this. This is the withdrawal from the, let's just do that, this. Those are the withdrawal from the depressant effects. And these are the withdrawal from the anti-anxiety effects. Yeah. So it's in two stages. I should say B is not this. And then over here, there's this. Then over that. But also, and I can just get this here. I'm just doing things, not just losing my mind. Point is, the first couple are the depressant effects, and the other ones the anti-anxiety effects. Most people choose not to take these drugs. These aren't fun for most people,
But if you have a history of alcohol use or a history of sedative use, you'll like these. Kelly.
What is DT?
The DTs, delirium tremens. That's when you get all shaky and it feels like there's bugs crawling all over your skin. Now, when I say if you like alcohol, you'll like these, that means if you have a liking reaction to alcohol, you have a liking reaction to drugs. Jamie?
Did you say that pain was within the depressant defense?
I know, that's anti-anxiety.
Thank you.
I think so. Yeah. Call. So you're if you have a liking effect to alcohol, you'll have a liking effect to these drugs, right? So if you like, you'll like. One of the things that used to happen a lot, doesn't happen as much as it used to, was what's called iatrogenic effects or iatrogenic use and doctor shopping. What that means is using them recreationally, but saying you're getting them for a disorder. So I show up at an MD's, I go, I'm really anxious, blah, 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 and I present all the symptoms. I'll just write you a thing for diazepam. It's a lot harder to do now because you can't really do doctor shopping anymore. All over Canada, you can't. Because your health card tracks all your prescriptions. So if you go into a doctor's office, they'll swipe your health card, right? And then the doctor has all your health records in front of them. So if you say, no, I've never had these drugs before, they go, oh, it says here you do all the time. But These systems were brought up for both pharmacies and for MDs because of people doing this. Yep.
So what is the iatrogenic?
Oh yeah, what does that mean? It means getting the drugs, saying you're getting them for a real disease or something, but you're actually getting them because you want to have fun. Yeah, want to abuse them. A common use is using them after a speed rush. So if you take meth and you take lots of it, and it's rushing, it's a weird feeling, so you want to smooth it out so you take some Valium. It's kind of like you take a lot of cocaine and you smooth it out with some heroin. I'm not saying you should do that, I'm saying people do that.
I just have a question about the liking reaction.
Yep.
So I know you said if you don't have a liking reaction to alcohol, you won't have a liking reaction to the drug.
Yeah.
Is there a certain reason why some people don't have a liking? Like, doesn't it affect your reward system? So why wouldn't someone like it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's something that's not very well understood. Sometimes people have almost an opposite reaction to what they should have to drugs. It's a, damn it, it has a name and I can't remember the name. It's not contradictory. It's a word like that. It's gonna bug me until I find it out, and I'll find it out. It'll come to me like 2 seconds after the class ends. But anyway, that does happen with any class of drugs. So for example, my mom not having a liking reaction to opiates is completely ass backwards. It also, she says, they keep her awake, which they aren't supposed to, but they do. There's no reason to disbelieve her because people do have those opposite reactions. Contradictory might be? Damn it, it's something like that. So that does happen. So there are people who have reactions to alcohol. Notice I just mumbled there, I don't know what the word was. I'll edit it in post. Paradoxical, thank you, that's the word. Modus mark.
Paradoxical.
Yeah, not popsicle. Having a popsicle reaction is different. That's when you just have a popsicle after some benzodiazepine, or you make a popsicle out of Valium. Things are getting a little weird now. So that does happen, and it's really not understood why it happens with someone. Because you're right, the physiology should be the same in everybody. Is it? And some people do literally. There are people who hate alcohol or other drugs.
You also said if someone doesn't like alcohol, so then they won't have a reaction to these drugs.
They won't have a liking reaction.
Okay, so is it they won't have a liking reaction to any drugs, or can they
ever? No, they won't have a liking reaction to these drugs and alcohol. They may really, 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 really like fentanyl.
Okay.
That's unlikely though. They're more likely to like cocaine.
Okay.
Because it wouldn't be this depressants. They would be having a liking reaction to it as well, like these things.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's a good question. We just don't know. Thank you for looking. Did you look it up or just figure it out? Thank you, man. Hero.
You're the best, Isaac.
Speak there. Birth defects, yeah. maybe for barbiturates, or sorry, maybe for benzodiazepines, definitely for benzodiazepines. You might have birth defects if you take these drugs when you're pregnant. Newborns do go through withdrawal because it crosses the blood-brain barrier and the placental barrier, obviously. You can have what are called demasculinizing effects. You get less testosterone with habitual use of these drugs. People can become aggressive and violent, which again sounds paradoxical, but that really isn't. That's more disinhibition. So the lethal dose shows no tolerance, and that's pretty common. And the effective dose shows tolerance. So that means the more you take these drugs, the closer you're getting to taking a dose that will kill you. That sounds dangerous. And that's true with both of these. Anything where I just say something and don't say this and this, it's true for both classes of these drugs. All right. Oh, you can overdose, obviously. All right, let's finish this bad boy up. Treatment. First thing you have to do is get through withdrawal, which is unpleasant, but you know, it's doable. So that's, you know, detox, right? You get through withdrawal, then you have to be around it. You don't take drugs for weeks and weeks. And this should be done under a physician's care. 12-step programs are used a lot. They're like Alcoholics Anonymous, so. What's really effective is something called contracting. Contracting works like this. I'm not going to tell anybody about your drug problem. We're also, however, going to be doing random drug testing with you. And if one comes back positive, I'm telling your wife. And then after that, I'm telling your mom. And after that, I'm going to tell your boss, or your friends, or your kids. And you sign a contract. It's very effective. Because people are embarrassed about this behavior. They don't like being drug addicts. Some people like it, but most people don't like being like this. So contracting has been, it's an interesting behavioral approach, which is just, look, I'm not gonna tell anybody, we're gonna work on your problems, teach you some new reinforcers, things like that. Oh, but if you do, we're gonna keep testing you, I don't trust you. And if we get a positive, let's list the least damaging to your life to most, and we'll start with the least, and we'll tell them. Oh, and by the way, you're telling them, not me. I'll be in the room making sure you do. Like, it works really well because there's real possible consequences. Real consequences. It's hard to get people to admit to even taking these drugs because they're in a recreational sense. So, treatment for anything, like we can talk about treatment for alcohol, treatment for cigarettes, treatment for, we can talk probably about cannabis. But all these other drugs that are being used illegally, it's very hard to get really solid treatment data for because not everybody's gonna tell you they're taking them because they're illegal. And there's a real stigma. All right, questions before we wrap up. Time for maybe one or two. Yeah.
So just it needs to be done under a doctor's care just because the symptoms are that bad.
Yeah. Yep. And let's see, Jamie, then John, and then we'll pack it in.
So earlier you were talking about the rats and how disinhibition makes them move more.
Yeah.
So would that movement just be like across the plane instead of like around the sides like they
do? Yes, they run all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah. And John, you had a front.
So you have to get detoxed. Ick?
Yeah, well, what happens is, first you gotta go to the withdrawal. Detox is a part where it's not treatment, it's just that you're not taking any drugs anymore. And that's also done under a doctor's care, because if you're going through really bad withdrawal, you really damage yourself. All right, we will talk about a little bit of whatever the next topic is next time, and also do a little bit of review and...
Must be something.
So thanks for listening to the lecture. I hope you got something out of it, as I noted in the intro. These are copyrighted, share alike 3.0 Canada, some rights reserved. So you can redistribute this all you want, but if you redistribute it, you can't make any money off of it. And also, if you mash it up, I get to mash up your stuff. Most of the vast majority of the music I found was on an old website called GarageBand, which doesn't exist anymore. And then it was called PodSafe Music. So this is all music that I have, that it's perfectly reasonable to, put on these podcasts. If you are interested, I can oftentimes find the name of the band. The name of the band will be listed in the post, and go look these bands up and buy their music, because if they're cool enough to let me use this, you should be cool enough to pay 99 cents or whatever to buy one of their songs. On that note, I will see you next time.